The name Buddha, the word, is a title, and it literally means someone who is awake, the awakened one. And that title then gives, can you hear? That title gives the name to what we call now the religion of Buddhism, the way or the teaching or the practice of the one who is awake, the practice of becoming awake. And I'm very fond of the word awake. Sometimes people will use the word enlightenment, the enlightened one. But that's a little bit confusing, that word, for many reasons. But the word awake to me is a lot simpler. And most of us have some experience of the delight of waking up. Maybe even if it's after some wonderful nap. And there's a kind of refreshment. If you wake up, you really feel awake, you know, you've been sleepy or dull or yawning or doing something, and then you wake up and it feels really great, refreshing and bright. And we could understand the practice of Buddhism is a practice of waking up, of becoming awake. And there's, you could kind of put it off into the future as some kind of great awakening, or you could see it as the attempt or the practice or the movement of being awake to what is happening right now, to waking up to what's happening now. What is this? Just being awake to it. And it has different connotations than saying being mindful or being focused on what's happening right now. Being mindful to some people can sound like work, to do something. But to be awake is more, there's a quality of effortlessness to it. Even though you might have to do something to kind of ignite the wakefulness, once you're awake, there's something effortless about it. And awake, the quality of being awake, has some wonderful qualities inherent in it. Though maybe we don't often think about it. So maybe I'll just tell you some that I think are there, and you can see in your experience whether you can't identify them in some experience you've had where you really felt bright, awake, here, present. One is, with being awake, there's often a feeling of really being clear and present. I'm here, reality is there, I can really see it, I'm here for it. There's a clarity of presence with our experience. Often the mind's not wandering away in daydream, lost in obsessions when we're awake. But there's a kind of a clarity of presence with the experience. Sometimes that presence of wakefulness has qualities of precision, where you can really see, the highlight, and clearly see how things are. In a small way, when I was home this evening, I was washing the dishes, and I had a little moment of wakefulness. And I was amazed at how colorful our kitchen was. I'd never taken in how colorful. There's boxes of red and boxes of green and different colors. And it all stood out kind of a highlight, you know, the details of what was going on. So there's kind of a discerning or discriminating or clarifying aspect of seeing what's there. And then there can be a quality of energy. Sometimes the energy is almost invisible, but certainly the lack of energy is absent. The feeling, oh, I'm so lethargic and tired and slugging through life. But there's a kind of energy, a brightness to the experience of being awake. And there's energy there. And then perhaps there's also the experience of some kind of joy in that experience of being awake. Maybe we don't think about it as joy, but a lightness, a brightness, a delight. Perhaps there's a feeling of balance or of equanimity. You know, when you really feel awake and bright, we're not so likely to be reactive to the things that happen around us or to us. When we're lost or confused or tired or obsessed, it's a lot easier to be reactive to what goes on in our life. But in really being awake and present, there's a little space or in our psyche, in our mind, where we're not so quick to kind of just react to someone saying, you know, I don't like people who have hair or people who don't have hair. You know, oh, okay, well, that's interesting news that you're that way, but you know, so it goes through. And so to be awake. So this is a task in Buddhism, is to discover wakefulness, to be awake. And in teaching Buddhism, the so-called Buddhism, the Buddha didn't teach Buddhism. It was an ism. He didn't. He was saved that headache. The Buddha taught, didn't teach a teaching like we would think of, like, you know, tenets, like a belief and philosophy. What's the philosophy of Buddhism? He didn't have to read those all his books in college, you know, philosophy of Buddhism. But what he said he taught that was special to what he had to teach was not what we call a philosophy, but he taught certain practices and certain states of mind that a person can have that are conducive and supportive and expressive of awakening. And central to this teaching, and he said this is really core to what he's teaching, was a list called the seven factors of awakening. Seven, I think of factors being like fractions. This, you know, if you divide up awakening in seven parts, you get these seven fractions of awakening. 1/7 of awakening, each one. Seven factors of awakening, seven aspects of awakening. And these are things that get awoken and get cultivated and recognized as people engage in the Buddhist path. And they're qualities that some teachers will emphasize we already know. It's aspects of our psyche that we already have, our being that we have. They're not something foreign we have to import, but rather things that we have experienced in our lives, we know, that somehow the psyche knows. And so we can orient ourselves a little bit around something that's already familiar. Some people will talk about practice as being a kind of homecoming, coming home to something that's already familiar, some place we feel at home and at rest. And so the factors of awakening are very similar to those qualities that I enumerated in relationship to being awake, qualities of what it's like to be awake. Right? So the seven factors of awakening, the first one is mindfulness, or real clear presence, the kind of presence we can see what's going on right now. The second is what's called investigation, or investigation of dharmas. Some kind of sense of investigating or inquiring or discriminating or being discerning about what it is we're present for. Maybe a little curiosity. So it's one thing to be present for something. Another to really look carefully and see what that is, to be present for it. The third is effort or energy. The fourth is joy. The fifth factor of awakening is tranquility, calm, being relaxed. And the sixth factor of awakening is called samadhi, often translated into English as concentration, but it's a unification of our being, of our mind, a harmonizing of all the different aspects of who we are into kind of a oneness, into a unity, into a kind of a stability and steadiness. And then there's equanimity. And equanimity is considered the most sublime of these, the most kind of... And equanimity is this phenomenal balance of mind that is not a neutral balance of mind. It's not a dullness or a blankness, but it's really a kind of a peak state of the psyche where it's so alert, so balanced, so awake that it's not going to be for or against our experience. It's not going to be affected by our experience, but it's going to be very clear and present for whatever's going on. So the seven factors of awakening. Some teachers will emphasize that they're done progressively in the sense that we start with mindfulness. Mindfulness is what we do, the practice we do. We add to the situation. And then the other six follow in the wake of mindfulness. Almost like a natural progression. You don't have to do anything really actively about the others. But if you do really diligent mindfulness, the others will follow. So the first then is mindfulness, which is what our main practice here. And perhaps we can use the word wakefulness rather than mindfulness to kind of change a little bit the habitual ways we have of thinking about it, those who've done a lot of mindfulness practice, we practice being awake to what our experience is as it's happening. And the emphasis as it's happening. We could say the lived experience now. Because often human beings don't live in the lived experience, don't abide their thoughts, their ideas, their are lost in the past, in the future, and obsessions, and ideas, and reactions. And so some people, they'd rather be anywhere but right here. Hopefully not right now. But anywhere but right now. You know, because it's uncomfortable, it's frightening, it's all kinds of things. Or we have such strong desires about something else that we want to get. So we want to try to get the grass is greener somewhere else. And so we can't rest here with this situation, this person we're talking to, because something else must be better. We're afraid we're going to miss something or lose something. There's a phenomenal number of activities of the mind which makes it difficult for human beings to actually be really be in the lived experience of the moment. Sometimes exceptional, or not so exceptional, but sometimes, you know, there are activities that kind of bring it on. I know some people will do dangerous sports, mountain climbing, for the way in which it really brings them into the present. They can't be anywhere else but right here. And it's really, you know, a peak experience to really be fully here and not have the mind be able to waver one bit from the present moment, because you know if you do, it's a long way down. And so, you know, we do it a little bit safer when we do mindfulness practice. We don't have to climb mountains to learn how to be present. But in a sense, it's harder to do it when we practice this way because the danger is not as high. And so we don't have that adrenaline going. But we're trying to learn to do it kind of in a more natural way, to understand the mind, to discover how the mind works, how to work with the mind in and of itself, and not use an external thing to help force the mind or bring the mind or inspire the mind into the present moment. So a lot of mindfulness practice is investigating, learning, discovering who we are. Who are we in the lived present? What is our experience like? Investigating, finding out. But that requires a certain level of mindfulness, of presence. And so we come back to the present moment. And what is this? And it's said that mindfulness is actually very easy. What's hard is remembering to do it. Or what's hard is keeping it up, keeping it going. You can, you know, show up and be here for a moment and then the mind goes off. So it's a training we do to learn how to be in the present moment, to be present, to come back. And it's also a training in learning what mindfulness is. And even though you might have heard a lot of different teachings about mindfulness and you think you might think it, know what it is, I think that it's always a kind of refinement and rediscovery of what is actually mindfulness. So what is it to be mindful? What are the qualities of mindfulness that we bring to bear in a situation? There's a wonderful simile the Buddha gave for mindfulness of describing kind of the quality of mindfulness of a goat herder who, during the growing season when the farms are all growing their crops, the goat herder has to watch really carefully over all the goats to make sure that they don't eat the crops. And it's a little bit kind of anxious, kind of right on top of everything. But when the growing season's over and all the crops have been harvested, then the goat keeper can rest up against the back of a tree, his back against the back of a tree, and just be relaxed and just kind of stay alert and watch the goats in the distance, make sure they don't run away too far or get stolen. But they can, he or she can just kind of be there kind of looking, very relaxed, without any anxiety, because they know the goats are not going to get into trouble. They're not going to eat those plants. And so mindfulness is that latter kind of awareness. It's relaxed, it's at ease with how things are. It's not anxious about how things are. It's not leaning into the future. It's not concerned about the details of what's happening. But it's a very relaxed observation, kind of from a distance. Everything's okay, watching, just being there with it. That's one aspect of mindfulness practice. It's a relaxed awareness. It's an unanxious awareness. It's an awareness of what's happening that has no agendas about what's happening. It's not trying to change what's happening, but rather to see what's happening, to be present for what's happening, to be what's happening, we could say. It's not to change what's happening, but to deepen what's happening. Not to change what's happening, but to deepen our experience with what's happening. So if we're trying to get rid of something or to change it, we're missing the opportunity to have a depth of experience with what's happening. It's kind of like someone who has a postcard of the coastal mountains here. And so they're always looking at that postcard. And it's a beautiful postcard. You know, it's great. And they show their friends, look at this beautiful postcard. And then at some point they realize, well, actually they can just put the postcard away and look up, you know, in the hills there. And it's beautiful there too. And actually it's a different kind of beauty. It's three-dimensional. And they realize they've been living in a two-dimensional world looking at the postcard. So many of us live in a two-dimensional world with our life. We have opinions and views and concepts and ideas about what we're experiencing. We interpret what we experience. And to a great extent, human beings live in the world of their concepts and interpretations of events and not in a kind of immediacy, a three-dimensional immediacy of what's actually being experienced. So part of what we're trying to do in mindfulness is to drop into a depth of experience with what's here. What does it mean to really to drop deeply into this moment right now? And there's different dimensions of the present moment. There's the experience we're having, what we're seeing and hearing and tasting and feeling. And there's also that aspect of the psyche that is being aware, that's taking that in. What's the quality of that? Is it present in a relaxed way? Is it anxious? Is it jumping on top of experience? How is it that we're with, how are we with the experience we're having? So to explore the nature of what it is to be present, to be mindful, and to be mindful, to wake up to what this experience is right now, and to look for the depth in it. As we kind of open to the experience, whatever it might be the breath we're having as we do breath meditation, it might be the body when we do body meditation, it might be the experience of having a conversation with someone, really being present for that and see what's the depth of the experience here right now, in me, in the room, and the person listening. It requires a certain kind of presence to take in much more of what's going on than the concepts and ideas of what's going on in the conversation. So then that comes the next factor of awakening, which is investigation. Part of the going deep, experiencing the depth of this moment, is to investigate or be curious. Look into this experience. Feel our way into the experience. Sense it more deeply. Discover what it is. Look behind the concepts we have, the ideas we have of what it is. What is it in its own right, in its directness itself? As the interest is there to investigate and find out what it actually is, if the interest is natural, the interest gets awakened because it's so interesting and we realize we don't know what reality is, perhaps, and we're kind of, what is it? We're curious. It tends to arouse energy. We want to do it. We want to engage in this sense of engagement, of curiosity, of energy. Oh yeah, this is really great. And you see that in almost any activity we're really interested in doing. If we have a hobby that we do and really interested in the hobby and we're engaged, time can stop or seem to stop. We kind of lose ourselves in the activity and the effort is there. The energy could be there. Almost easily and naturally because we're really interested in that. So to have the interest factor aroused brings energy, brings effort, the natural kind of effort to the practice. Part of the function of effort, of energy, is to help the mindfulness become continuous. So that it isn't just, touching into a moment of mindfulness and then, coming back 5 minutes later. But putting together moments of mindfulness so it's continuous moment after moment. So the effort, the interest, the energy is there to keep it going in the present moment. What's this? What's this? In maintaining the mindfulness continuously, there's a variety of ways of doing that. One way, of course, is just to choose one object, like the breath, and just cultivate mindfulness on the breath, like some people do that in meditation. Another way of doing it, kind of almost the opposite end of the spectrum, rather than choosing one thing to focus on and stay mindful of, is to do what's called choiceless awareness, to open awareness up and just be aware of whatever is being revealed in the present moment. Not choosing, not being what is there, giving up control of what is there, but then become very interested, very present for what arises. Now there's a sound, now there's a thought, now a feeling. Now a body pain stays for a while. And so just kind of open to the realm of experience in the way that it shows itself in the present moment. And this is a wonderful thing to do. It's very freeing. Because it's what's most very common for people, like everyone, probably most of you here, all of you here probably. The mind has some is reactive. It's quite quick to judge, to criticize, to want to push away, to be afraid. It's very rare for the mind to leave the experience alone as it actually is. It wants to do something with it. What's in it for me? What does it say about me? My self-image? You know, all kinds of things go on. You know, the mind's always kind of trying to figure out, manipulate, and orient itself around what that experience is. When we start doing the continuous mindfulness, then what we try to do is be mindful of each thing that arises and to hold it with some spaciousness, some awakefulness, letting it be as it is. So we say, for example, we're staying with the breath, being mindful of the breathing. And then a thought occurs. It, whatever that's supposed to be, is not happening fast enough in my meditation. I'm not getting concentrated quickly enough, mindful enough. I'm not awake yet. You know, just... And so the mindfulness catches it. Oh, look at that. And you're mindful of a moment of being reactive, of judging. There's judging. And then a moment later, there is impatience. You say, oh, there's impatience. The next moment, perhaps, there's a thought. I've been meditating for a long time. I shouldn't be impatient. So one option you have isn't to criticize yourself for having that thought. But what we try to do with mindfulness, as being continuous, is to get out of this flow of the reactivity. Get out of the flow of the thoughts and ideas and interpretations we have of the experience and see it. Be present for it. Notice it. So the Buddhists talk about that there's two streams that we can be in. One stream is the stream of our reactions, our thoughts, our thinking, our judgments, our self-identity, our self-image, our self-definition, a stream of attachment, a stream of clinging, a stream of resistance. And we put and normally we're going along in life carried along in that stream of attachment. The second stream, or current in the same river, but the current that goes upriver, is that of mindfulness, of awareness. That presence that doesn't buy into, or doesn't invest into, or doesn't get hooked into what's going downriver. So you're in the water, you're swimming along, and this wonderful boat floats down. It's one of those, you know, it's great. It's one of those floating casinos. Mm-hmm. You know, and all this seductive stuff that's happening in that casino, it just looks so great. And the next thing you know, you're on the casino, flowing down the river. Because you've gotten attached. To flow upstream, you have to let go of that attachment. You see the casino going down the river. You say, oh, look at that. It's a casino. Look at the bright colors. Look at that. Oh, here comes my attachment. It rises. I'm attached. I want that. But you see it. As long as you keep in the seeing, keep looking, being present, you're not going to go on the casino. You might have all kinds of reactions, but you keep seeing them. This is what's happening. This is what's happening now. As opposed to getting hooked on the reactions, believing them. So you're allowed to be exactly as you are, have the reactions you have, but what you're asked to do is to step out of that current and then to watch it and see it. And in doing that, you begin floating upstream rather than downstream. So part of the effort aspect of practice is the effort to be continuous and keep it up so that we don't get swept up by the stuff that is appearing in the present moment. This is why I like I think the I think there should be two bumper stickers for Vipassana students. One should say, "I stop for everything," which means whatever arises, I'm going to be there for it and really be present and be awake to it. The other side of the bumper should say, "I don't stop for anything." And this that when it doesn't stop for anything means that I'm going to be present for everything, but I'm not going to get into anything. I'm not going to get on that stream going downstream. I'm going to keep the flow of mindfulness going upstream. I'm going to keep noticing now what's happening now, now what's happening now. So the effort is there. Then as the effort is there to investigate, be present, at some point, then what can arise is something that's called a rapt interest. The interest is not just simply, you know, there, you know, it's, you know, the interest begins taking the quality of being rapt, rapturous, of being delighted. It's kind of like a natural joy that arises when the psyche is fully engaged and interested and present for what's actually going on now. Maybe in the way that someone feels some level of joy when they're completely involved in a hobby or completely involved in reading a book or completely involved in a conversation. There's complete interest and involvement in some activity. So the same thing in meditation. Complete involvement and presence and engagement and interest can give birth to a certain kind of joy. Another thing that can bring joy is when we start flowing upstream rather than downstream. It means that we're no longer taking on the burden of our attachments, our clinging. We no longer have obstacles. We're no longer allowing things to be obstacles. We're no longer being weighed down by all the kind of reactions of the mind and the heart. And it's delightful not to have to carry all these burdens. Some people carry armor. Tons and tons of heavy armor. And, you know, you're really safe, aren't you? It's really good. You know, I have this image of these big, shiny knights and shining armor, right? Heavy, strong armor. And they're ready to fight anybody. And then some kid comes along and just pushes them over. And they can't get up because it's so heavy. So we're really safe, right? So some people carry armor, but they're protected. They're not going to open their hearts to anybody. They're just closed, and that's thank you. That's the way it should be. Or we're so afraid, and that's a heavy weight. Or we're so filled with ambition and desire. You know, all kinds of ways in which we're weighed down by our experience. But to have the mindfulness start becoming continuous means we're no longer succumbing to that, and we're beginning to lighten. The metaphor or simile that's used in the ancient text is that of a bird taking off in flight. At first, it takes effort for the bird to flap and flap and flap. At some point, it gets enough velocity going, it can just let its wings kind of out, and the updrafts kind of carry it. Effortless, it's light. I imagine if I was a bird, I'd be happy at that point. It'd bring me joy to kind of be, you know, soaring like that. So joy is a factor of the path. It's important to realize that because sometimes Buddhist teachings sounds pretty like Buddhism is a party pooper. You know, no attachments, no clinging, no self. You know, if you don't have a self, how do you go to the parties, right? So this is really bad religion. And so it can sound that way a little bit, but there's actually a lot of joy, happiness, and delight. Some wonderful things that come with practice. Beautiful qualities of heart get born. The best in human heart has a chance to come out if we stop being in the way of it. And some of these qualities are the factors of awakening. So then as we feel some joy, this is said to be a condition for relaxing, for becoming calm, becoming tranquil. To no longer be in conflict with ourselves is calming, is tranquil. To no longer be in conflict with the world is relaxing, is calming. For a lot of people in our lives, probably the most important aspects of mindfulness is not enlightenment, but rather it's relaxation, stress reduction. It's very, very effective, very helpful. It's part, a very important part of the path. And I think a lot of people need to understand, in order to meditate well, need to learn to relax. and to have the kind of soothing or softness, softening of the body, the settling of the body, the opening of the body that is part of tranquility and calmness. Calmness in the body sets in. And a calmness of the mind, where the mind is not tense, the mind is not exhausted, the mind is at ease, peaceful, tranquil. When the mind starts being relaxed and calm, when the body is calm and relaxed, then it's a lot easier to get concentrated. Some people try to get concentrated when they're still tense. It just doesn't work. But to have the mind relaxed, to have the mind lightened, delighted, having some joy and happiness in it, and then to have the mind relaxed or calm, it's really helpful for what's called samadhi. And samadhi is when the calmness is there enough and the focus is there enough that the psyche and the body begins to reorganize itself in such a way that it's no longer fragmented and all the different forces in our psyche and body going in different directions, the way it can often be in our lives. And things begin to align themselves together. The word for one-pointedness, what's translated as one-pointedness in Buddhism, ekagata, probably is better translated as alignment. Things are becoming aligned. Our being becomes sort of harmonizing, unifying of the being. We get composed right here. And then with a mind which is a mind body which is composed, stable, steadied, with a being which is not fragmented in all kinds of ways, then we begin discovering that capacity to be non-reactive. It's very hard to live in a mind which is non-reactive. So it's very important not to set that up as a standard to measure ourselves against, to beat ourselves up because we're being reactive to our experience. Just keep coming back to the mindfulness. Oh, there's reactivity. Wow. So we just keep noticing this is what's going on, without judgment, without aversion, just noticing. But as it builds momentum, this practice, at some point you come to a place where the mind is very developed, very strong. The effort there, the strength is there, the presence is there, the harmonizing of the being is there, the sense of well-being is there. That the mind is so balanced that no matter what happens, the mind is going to be equanimous, balanced. Some people might say it's like the mind is so big, so huge, so strong, so powerful, perhaps, that it doesn't really matter what happens. All kinds of things can happen. It's like being a huge, big rhinoceros and a fly lands on your buttocks. Well, I say that because there was a little 6-year-old girl at yoga class earlier. She comes regularly and she counts every time how many times Terry uses the word buttocks in her class. She thinks that's really cool. Today was only 5 times. Anyway, so this, fly lands on the rhinoceros' buttocks. And fly doesn't mind, right? So to have the mind kind of strong or powerful, or some people have heard the word empty. Sometimes the mind feels empty, translucent, transparent. The fly just goes right through. It doesn't land anywhere. In different qualities, different ways that equanimity is experienced. But the essential aspect is this thing of not reacting for or against. The mind doesn't lose its balance. And when the mind is no longer reactive, when the mind is balanced, when the heart is balanced, has that ease, can rest in that place, then something extraordinary has a chance to happen. Something that cannot happen when we're always moving, always reacting, always in charge, always trying to manipulate or do something. Always trying to figure out who we are, try to make ourselves to be somebody. But be at peace, at ease, and equanimous with how things are. To lose our self-consciousness in that equanimity. It allows for something to happen. And perhaps a little story, maybe, will give some indication of this. It's a story about a Zen monastery, a Zen monk, who had been a very diligent practitioner for many, many years. I don't know, 25, 30 years of very diligent practice. He was an exemplary monk. He had developed his mind to a great way. He had great concentration, great mindfulness, great compassion. He had looked and resolved and dealt so much of his conceit. He was kind of humble and simple. He had tremendous firmness and strength of effort and energy. He was engaged, strong intent, involved with his experience. He was an exemplary monk. He had reached the pinnacle of many things, of many forms, many aspects of his Zen practice. But he had still not awakened. And people were kind of amazed. He's been here for so long and he's not awakened. How could this be? He's perfected as a practitioner in so many ways. So the abbot said to him, come with me. And he took him up into this room in the monastery. And this room had nothing in it. No window. Nothing in it. No window, just walls. And a very solid gate as a door. Solid, like a jail. Big, solid bars. Complicated hinges. Been built to last. You can't break through it. And it had a huge lock on that gate. And it was a complicated lock. Many different kind of ways that things you had to do to kind of open it up. And the abbot put the monk in that room, closed that door, that gate, and said to the monk, you have 3 days to figure out how to get out of this room. And in 3 days, if you're not out of this room, we're kicking you out of the monastery. That's it for you. So he went to work to try to figure out how to open that door. There was no other way out to that door. And he had tremendous concentration, great mindfulness and presence. He didn't react. He could see how his mind worked. He focused very intently. He investigated that door. Was completely involved. At times he was really joyful, kind of figuring out this door, looking at the hinges, measuring the lock, putting little things in the, inside the little lock hole and a combination, trying to figure out, exactly how it's built and how it's done and trying different things and a lot of focus. Also he was the fruit of his practice was really there. He had a tremendous equanimity. He knew the consequences were dire for him. But he could keep his equanimity. All those different factors of awakening were there for him. And he tried for 1 day, he tried for 2 days, he didn't sleep, he tried for 3 days. It was getting right near the end. And he was, looking, and he was sitting, and he was kind of looking around this way, that way, kind of trying to understand the door, trying different things, trying to figure out, how do you open this door? It was getting near the end, and he couldn't figure anything out. Nothing made any sense to him. And so he just stood there. He stood there, still. His equanimity was still very powerful there. He's balanced. He realized he was just there. He allowed himself just to be there. All the effort was still there. The strength in him was still there for all those hours of days of practice and working. He was still humming from his engagement with it all. But nothing was working, so he just stood there. He stopped all his efforts. He just stood there. And as he stood there up against the door, the gate, he kind of very gently, his body swayed and leaned up a little bit and pushed against the door. and it opened. It had never been locked. But he needed to be completely still, not trying to do anything, in a sense having given up everything. He had to come to complete stillness in order to let the door open. May the gate over your heart be as easy to open. It is that easy. Because the deepest gate, the most fundamental gate, is not something you can open. But the seven factors of awakening have to be mature for you to have the equanimity so you can absolutely do nothing. The kind of nothing that only can occur when the psyche, the heart, is so well developed. The equanimity is so powerful that only then will your door open. And then you'll walk out the door. And as they say in the Zen world, you'll walk out that door, walk out your gate with gift-bestowing hands. May your practice of mindfulness be a gift to the world. So, thank you very much.